It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Queenie Kim, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Today is Friday, December 28th, and thanks for joining us. For this part of the show, we're going to talk about the generational divide among immigrant communities when it comes to politics. And we're going to do this by jumping off some of the recent news dividing the Vietnamese community. Since 2018, there's been an agreement with between the U.S. and Vietnam that protects Vietnamese who come to this country before the year 1995 from being deported. Earlier this month, multiple news agencies reported that the Trump administration was reinterpreting the agreement so that Vietnamese who have committed crimes can be deported from this country. LA Times reporter Ann Doe has covered Orange County and its large Vietnamese community, and in reporting the latest deportation threat, she's discovered an interesting split within the region's Vietnamese-American population. She joins us here today, and she'll tell us about this split in a second, but I wanted to welcome you, Ann. Ann, thanks for joining us on the show.
Queena, thank you so much for having me.
Cool. And we've also got Thu Hung Nguyen Vo. She's an associate professor of Asian languages and cultures and Asian American studies at UCLA. Hey, Thu Hung.
Hi, Queena. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. And last but not least, we have Fernando Guerra. He's a professor of political science in Chicana and Latina studies at Loyola Marymount University. He's also a member of the Southern California Public Radio's Board of Trustees. Hi, Fernando.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, thanks. And since we're jumping off your story, let's start with you. Real quick, can you give us the really short history of why the Vietnamese who came to this country before 1995 have this sort of protected status?
Well, there was an agreement signed under the Bush administration to protect this refugee community, and they've always felt secure knowing this. And a lot of people, especially from the younger generation, started becoming involved in immigration and progressive politics recently.
And I guess why did the Bush administration feel that this group of people should have this sort of status?
The United States has been welcoming to Vietnamese Americans since 1975, when the Vietnam War ended. And at that time, President Ford had lobbied Congress and the public to allow a certain number in and to set them up in sponsorships. And following that, there were refugee camps set up around the country, the closest to our area being at Camp Pendleton. And so, you know, it's the traditional welcome mat to people in need. And also, you know, Vietnam and U.S. were allies in the war.
So it's sort of a legacy from the refugee program after that war. And now that the Trump administration wants to reinterpret this, if you've committed a crime, they want to deport you. What sort of crimes are we talking about here? Who have you met that fits this profile?
Various crimes, a lot of felonies, some misdemeanors. This population has been living in limbo for a number of years, and there are more than 9,000 Vietnamese Americans, Vietnamese who are affected and could be very vulnerable to threats of deportation.
And then what you found is that while younger Vietnamese Americans overwhelmingly oppose the White House move to deport these folks, those of the older generation has basically been sort of silent and don't necessarily oppose it. Tell us about that split and what you found in terms of what's driving it.
Yes, the older generation focuses on the homeland in terms of political involvement. That's not their sole focus, but it's been a primary trajectory. And there's a huge anti-communist movement, and the constant fight for human rights and religious freedom permeates everything that many Vietnamese elders do in the community. I've covered dozens of protests, and this is a recurring theme. The younger generation would like to see the older become more involved in local politics or issues involving domestic, you know, debates. They totally appreciate and are grateful for the sacrifices of their parents and grandparents. But at the same time, they also feel the need and the longing to give back to this country which has offered so much refuge.
And that's interesting, that whole the first generation sort of looking homeland and the second generation looking, you know, closer to home. It sort of flicks to the last person you spoke to in your study. She was you describe her as a 70-year-old grandmother. Is it Am Nguyen? I'm pronouncing that name correctly. And she seems to sort of capsulize what that generation of Vietnamese Americans feels about being here in the United States. Can you tell us what she said and explain that sentiment a little in terms of this divide?
Yes, she was a refugee sent to the Palawan Island in the Philippines and stayed there for 8 months before they were granted a space in the U.S. And she said that once you're here, you need to follow the rules here. If you can't do that, you should not be given a second chance. And that's partly reflective in some of the older generation thinking. I'm not saying that everyone feels that way, but there's a significant population that does. And before the story ran, I was planning to go cover the protests, and I had called some of the elderly people who are common participants in protests, and they said, oh, we're not planning to do that. This is not our issue. And after the story published, there were others who either emailed me or texted me who said, you know, it's great that the LA Times is capturing some of the younger voices, and we admire their passion. It's illustrative of our passion when we were much younger. But this is a particular issue that we feel we give the arena to the younger folks. They feel more strongly about it. We're still fighting for the people left behind.
And I wanted to sort of dig into that that part of your article. And it's this notion about that's been out there, that there's sort of this monolith of an immigrant community when it comes to the Trump administration's immigration policy, and that, you know, as a whole, the whole monolith of the immigration community categorically opposes his immigration policies. And that doesn't seem to be entirely true. I wanted to sort of dig into that notion a little bit, the divide between immigrant communities in terms of how they see these policies. But first, I wanted to invite listeners to join us in this conversation. If you're from an immigrant family, are you seeing this generational split play out in your family? If you are, call us at 866-893-5722. Tell us how you understand this split in terms of what drives it. Does assimilation play a part, or maybe the role of ethnic media? Call us at 866-893-5722. We'd love to hear about your experiences and your analysis on this split. We're at 866-893-5722. But let's go next to Tu Hung while we're waiting for for folks to call in. And you've seen this generational split from two points of view. One is between your parents and yourself, your 1.5 generation here, and then yourself and your children. But I wanted to get into that generational split between you and your parents, or the folks who immigrated here and the folks who grew up here. And you say that what's happening here is that they're talking across each other's historical context. What does that mean?
Yeah, so because I'm from the 1.5 generation, I share a little bit of the history with the first generation, but I also have like children and students who belong to the second generation. So I can see a little bit from both sides. Day in and day out, both in my job and also in my life as a parent, I see and share the pain that young people experience faced with racial inequality in this country. This is the only country that they know. So unlike their parents and grandparents, right? An issue like the Trump administration's push for mass deportation feels like a move by the gatekeepers to determine who belongs to America and who doesn't. Mm-hmm. And it looks like the gatekeepers are trying to push out and keep out people who are not white. So this country and its history of racism is what young Vietnamese Americans must live with. And progressive politics allow them to ally with other communities of color in the struggle for racial justice. But what I can see from the first generation is that they come out of an entirely different historical context. Their country of origin, South Vietnam, was a struggling post-colonial
state.
I'm really sorry
to do this. We're going to be returning to this conversation, but we got to go to a break right now. We'll also be joined by Fernando Guerra about talking about the Latino community and how the split is playing out there. But stay with us. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We'll be back after the break. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Queenie Kim in for Larry Mantle today. We've been talking about the generational split in opinions within Southern California's Vietnamese community when it comes to the issue of immigration. And we're broadening up the conversation to talk about the split in the immigrant community at large. Joining us in this conversation is LA Times reporter Ann Doe. We also have Tu Hung Nguyen Vo. She's an associate professor of Asian languages and culture at UCLA. And we have Fernando Guerra. He's a professor of political science and Chicano and Latina studies at Loyola Marymount University. He's also a member of Southern California Public Radio's Board of Trustees. And Tung, I wanted to just really quickly wrap up with you before we left. We were sort of talking about the split being understood as talking in between like these sort of historical contexts. And sort of what I heard from you is that the second generation, well, I guess basically feels more American, and these rights really apply to them in maybe a way that the first generation hasn't quite felt assimilated.
Well, I don't really want to apply that assimilationist paradigm to understand the situation. Mm-hmm. I think it's the context of American racism and this, historical context of American racism that the second generation has to live with. And the first generation, their experience coming out of colonial war, anti-colonial war, but also they experienced socialism in post-war Vietnam in the form of like more war, imprisonment, economic deprivation, and political repression. So if we add to the way that they like left the country where their survival rate might have been 50%, we're talking about major trauma. So, it's a lot of different historical variables at work here. So when the first generation came here, they couldn't make their experience understandable to Americans, already turned against the Vietnam War as a misadventure, blaming the South Vietnamese allies for American defeat in pretty racist terms reserved for like the third world in terms of like authoritarianism, incompetence, corruption. In other words, like uncivilized servants who couldn't really carry out America's bidding. And of course, like the left hasn't really been much better. They've long decided that South Vietnamese were merely puppets of American imperialism. That's pretty dehumanizing of a whole class of people as well. Mm-hmm. So progressive and socialists did not welcome Vietnamese refugees into this and other Western countries. They were anti-refugee demonstrations from the late 1970s and the early 1980s, where people from the left held up signs saying no asylum to South Vietnamese puppets and thieves. Mm-hmm. So the only way for Vietnamese refugees to fit in has been to express their gratitude for the relative safety here and the problematic model minority story reserved for Asians as a racial group in America. They've been bound into that impossible story by racism on both the left and the right. So, it's a completely different context.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a very different context with the Vietnamese. Well, let's turn to Fernando. Fernando, you've been looking at this split and sort of broadening out the conversation. You've said that the split follows a similar pattern with other immigrant groups. And it pretty much comes down to this one question, which is how they see the role of government, the difference in opinion between first and second generation. Can you explain that to us a little bit?
Sure. I mean, to reemphasize the point that none of these groups are monolithic. When you talk about Latinos, you're talking about Mexican, Cuban, Puerto Ricans. When you talk about Asians, you're talking about Vietnamese, Chinese, Filipinos. Each group has a different experience. Mm-hmm. And even individuals within those groups come in at different times. And the role of government during that time when they came in plays a role in how they see and how loyal they are to government. Like any comparison, it's not perfect. But when I take a look at the Vietnamese experience, it's very similar to the Cuban-American experience, whereas I see the Chinese experience much more similar to the Mexican experience. And you can already begin to see differences there.
Yeah, so explain that Mexican experience to me and And do you see this sort of generational split within that community? And we should also, you know, you bring up a really good point that we should have a general caveat here that we're talking in broad generalizations. It's sort of the nature of this conversation. And obviously, you know, there are many, many different types of people in every group. But generally speaking, are you seeing a split in the Latino or the Mexican-American community, if you want to drill down more? And what do you attribute that to if you are seeing it?
So you're absolutely right that every pattern is different. However, there are some similarities amongst all immigrants and even European immigrants is that the loss of language, the synchronization of different cultures and all that. So while many differences, there are also some similarities. What we're seeing here today in this Trump era is that Latino community, both immigrant and non-immigrant, foreign-born and U.S.-born, Mexican, Puerto Rican, Central American, et cetera, are pretty united in terms of immigrant rights, whether it's the Hondurans and the caravan or whether it's DACA students or whether it's Latino veterans being deported or even this issue about Vietnamese. It's overwhelmingly against the Trump administration. And while, you know, we understand that what's going on here is that Trump is playing up to his base in national politics, Trump doesn't care about international agreements and what had happened before and has no historic sense of that and doesn't care about it. And he's always focused on immigrants, especially criminal immigrants, to rally his base and make himself feel good. And oftentimes he makes no distinction between not only legal immigrants and undocumented immigrants, but even U.S.-born. Look at the case where he took on the U.S.-born Latino judge that was looking at his case at Trump University, and he lashed out against him because he sees it as an us versus them.
Yeah, and I can see that the Trump administration has very much, at least from the feeling of most immigrant groups, racialized this conversation on immigration and immigration policy. I'm wondering, before President Trump took office, did you see more nuances in this conversation when it wasn't so, I guess, racist? I mean, it's really the lack of, I mean, lack of a better word in a way. That because I know from just anecdotally from friends of mine who are Mexican-American and born here, they did feel that there was a big divide between the way they felt about immigrants' rights and their parents who were a little bit more aligned with Trump and took a little bit more of a, maybe not Trump, but took a little bit more of a conservative view on immigration.
Right. And, you know, it's not only hearsay. We have a ton of public opinion, even voting behavior, demographic, consumer behavior that shows the difference between older generation Latinos or Mexicans and younger generation.
And flesh that out for me. What are you seeing?
So even then, the divide is not as great as what you're seeing right now with the Vietnamese in Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
They're a lot closer in terms of their views. Like many elders, they feel that this country has been accepting in the fact that they're just here. Maybe they still see discrimination and all that, but they want to give loyalty to this country and not challenge the government or elected officials. And so they tend to not want to protest to the same degree that younger U.S.-born individuals who feel very American and feel that the values that America espouses should be upheld in all kind of situations. And so there you see somewhat of a conflict. But Trump has allowed for that difference to really be brought together, because even the elder Latinos are very much pro-immigrant now, and that movement's been caused by the current political environment.
Yeah, and you're touching on this thing that I've been thinking about for a while. And there's long been this myth in politics that when the immigrant community matures, you know, 2040, when we become a minority majority country, it's been this it's been implied that, of course, they're going to go Democrat and they're going to see a huge boost. From my own personal experience as a second generation Korean American, I always felt that notion was wrong. I always felt like that in some ways, the immigrant vote was the Republicans to lose. Generally speaking, you know, immigrants tend to be a little bit more socially conservative. They came to this country with very little, sort of pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, or that's the mythology that they give themselves, and often it's true. But you say, Fernando, that this analysis is a little bit more nuanced. It's not as black and white.
No, you're absolutely right. If you take a look, again, from public opinion, Latinos and Asian Americans are much more socially conservative along all kinds of different areas. And when Republicans take a look at that, they say, man, they're like us. They should be voting for us. And they go and approach them about being, pro-life, anti-gay, et cetera. And while what happens is that Latinos and Asians tend to say, okay, we might have those beliefs, but we don't believe that government should be talking to us about that. It makes us feel uncomfortable. That's a discussion that should occur within the family, within the church, within the community, not in terms of government. And then when Democrats approach them and don't talk about that, but talk about economic issues or health issues, that's a lot more appealing. And we picked this up from focus groups and also public opinion that clearly shows, especially Asians, have moved to the Democratic side of the aisle tremendously over the last 15 to 20 years because they feel that government should be talking about economic and health issues, not these other issues. And so Republicans started off with an advantage, and then they blew that advantage in terms of their approach, which was very strong-willed and not nuanced.
And Ando, I'm wondering if you're seeing that a similar dynamic play out in the Vietnamese American community. I know that they have been traditionally Republican and more on the conservative side, but that seems to be changing as well. Are we seeing it cross generations, or is it really the first versus second generation?
I think that what you mentioned, Quina, is that the 1.5 and even the second generation is leaning left more. These are folks who are involved in daily living. Just from the street reporting, this is what I see. You know, they're raising children themselves, as Professor Nguyen mentioned, and you know, they know what's happening more in the local world.
And I'm sorry to cut you off here. It's the nature of this show. We've been speaking to Ando, LA Times reporter, Tu Hung Winwo, a professor at UCLA, and Fernando Guerra, professor at Loyola Marymount University. I'm Queenie Kim. You're listening to Air Talk. Stay with us here. I'm Queenie Kim, sitting in for Larry Mantle, and you're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're almost at the end of 2018, and I know it's the holidays and the season for hope and gratitude, and I'm sorry to bust your bubble here with the next segment, which is about the big one. And if you're from here, you know what I'm talking about. It's a catastrophic earthquake that we've all been hearing could come any time now. Well, in January, it will have been 25 years since the last big one hit Southern California. And what I'm talking about, of course, is the Northridge earthquake. And so next month, KPCC will debut a new podcast. It's called The Big One. I'm in the studio with the two producers of this podcast, KPCC's podcast team, who produce The Big One. It is Misha Youssef. She is the head producer of The Big One podcast. Hey.
Hi, Queenie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. And Jacob Margolis, he's the host of the podcast. Hey.
Hey.
Hey, Jacob, let's start with you. Why did you and KPCC decide to do this podcast, The Big One? Not the most uplifting.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where I live as science reporter. But, you know, one of my earliest memories was the Northridge quake. It's one of the earliest and scariest. And when it hit my family, we had to leave our house. Our lives were in disarray for a while.
Where did you live?
We live in Woodland Hills.
Okay, right. So right around this epicenter.
Not very far. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as you know, L.A. was just crippled. And the big one we know will be worse than Northridge. And we've been hearing about it for a really long time in bits and pieces. And over all these years, there have been a lot of advancements in technology and the science and our understanding about what it's going to, how it's going to happen, what's going to happen when it hits. And we've actually lived these quakes before. And so what that means is we have a really compelling, really personal story to tell about the big one and the fallout and how people's lives in Southern California will be changed forever when it does hit. When Southern California, I mean, Southern California will be changed forever. Yeah. So compelling story.
Yeah.
And timely.
And Misha, you say the podcast isn't sort of the straight ahead documentary that we're accustomed to. It takes a fiction, nonfiction approach. Why did you guys decide to go that route?
Yeah, so we're doing a couple things differently, specifically to get people to listen and to make an impact in their lives. And I think the two big things that we're doing is, one, we're blending fiction and nonfiction, because ultimately this is speculative journalism. It's based on scientific data, on research that has already been done. But because the earthquake hasn't yet happened, we don't know exactly how it will play out. Mm-hmm. So we've created a fiction narrative to take people through what will happen.
Like the future. And then,
exactly.
And then the nonfiction looks at the past. Is
exactly.
That sort of
the nonfiction is the part of disaster survivors, mm-hmm. and talking to scientists and structural engineers and people who've been involved in understanding what this quake will do. And the other cool thing we're doing is we have this disaster movie soundscape. So we have an original score by Andy Clausen, who's incredibly talented, and it's very dramatic and cinematic, and I'm super excited for everybody to hear it.
And wasn't there another reason? Did I remember this correctly, that there's research that shows that people listen more to stories in terms of preparation than just scientists or experts and talking heads talking about facts? Tell me about that a little bit.
Yeah, so we talked to some people who are now part of the USGS, who were responsible for communicating the extent of the earthquake in Christchurch, New Zealand. One of them was this woman, Sarah McBride, who told us that just scientific information, facts and tidbits don't actually make an impact, but instead stories have a much larger ability to get people to do something about it. And the other thing we're doing is we're putting the whole series in second person. So you, the listener, are our hero. We're speaking directly to you about what you can and cannot do and about what you will experience.
So let's hear a little bit of this. We've got a clip. You want to set it up for us?
Yeah, for sure. So this is from the first episode where our hero is looking at a collapsed building and decides to help.
All right. Well, let's hit it.
You walk a few blocks towards the financial district. The dust is getting thicker. You pull your shirt up over your face so you don't choke on it, but you can barely see in front of you. You hear people screaming. You look up. A 55-story building has collapsed. You can hardly see through the haze, but you see outlines of twisted steel beams and piles of concrete. Oh my God, these poor people.
Sounds a little scary there.
It's
not quite the thing that I want to think about now. But Misha, this isn't just about scaring people. You want people to act. How does that work here?
Yeah, so one of the important parts of the show is the survival guide aspect of it. So it's the big one, your survival guide. And at the end of every episode, we're giving you very specific practical tips on what you can do to prepare.
And Jacob, in mm-hmm. doing this podcast, you've talked to a lot of civic leaders, business leaders, to try and figure out how far have we come since the last big one to prepare for the next big one. What have you been hearing?
Well, the last big one was in 1857 in this area.
Oh, we don't consider the Northridge earthquake the big one?
We don't.
Wow.
And
so how big would the big one be then?
In our scenario, it's a 7.8 mm-hmm. earthquake. It could potentially be even bigger, and it's on the San Andreas Fault, mm-hmm. just outside of LA, that kind of runs through the desert. And we did talk to a lot of people. We talked to a lot of private companies, a lot of public, institutions. And I would say that some feel like they're prepared, some don't. And so when I think about the government, for instance, I think about like LA City. We went and talked to Mayor Garcetti. Talking to him, he clearly has a deep breadth of knowledge on the issue. And LA itself has implemented some really strong retrofit programs for certain types of buildings. That said, there are also other kinds of buildings that we know will be a risk in an earthquake that don't have a retrofit program designed to fix them yet. That's probably because of political costs.
And what percentage of the buildings,
that
you have any sort of ballpark, I won't hold you to it, but were you talking like half the buildings have been retrofitted? Or
We'll have to reveal that in our big
building episode. All right, so we got to wait. All right.
Yeah, and so then I also talked to other agencies that, we hopped on the phone with some folks who had no idea that this thing was coming. They just knew that this is, everyone knows it's an earthquake zone, but they didn't have a specific plan. So that was kind of scary. But then there are places like LADWP, right? They've done a really fantastic job preparing for this, done very interesting work to prepare for this thing. And they're very honest that the whole retrofit to the water system in this region is going to take them over 100 years to do. Mm-hmm. And that partially has to do with money. It partially has to do with just like the size of the system. So you at the same time, you also have groups like that that are they know what they have to do, but just the size, the amount of time and all that kind of stuff. So by the end of all this, by the end of talking to all these different people, some days I was really hopeful. Sometimes I was kind of filled with hopelessness. But I know Misha kind of vacillated as well.
Yeah. How did you feel at the end of this? Because it doesn't sound that hopeful to me. I have to listen to the podcast still, but...
Yeah, I definitely went from being terrified to being hopeful, and now I'm kind of indifferent. Part of it, I think...
I'm not indifferent. I think I ended up being hopeful.
I think part of it is there's only so much you can do, and we've been working on this project for a year. So when other people are excited, I'm sure I'll be more impacted, too.
All right, real quick, what is the one thing we can do that you learned that surprised you, other than, you know, the gallons of water or whatever? Either one of you. Go for it.
Other than the gallons of water?
Yeah.
I mean, that's like one of the arguably one of the most important things.
Yeah.
1 gallon per person per day and have some food.
So that's the thing, your takeaway. All right,
go. Don't go to bed naked and keep a pair of shoes under your bed in case it hits in the middle of the night.
All right. Well, there you have it. Shoes and water. That was Jacob Margolis and Misha Youssef from KPCC's podcast team. Their latest podcast is called The Big One. You can listen to the trailer right now wherever you find your podcast. Just search for The Big One, KPCC. The podcast itself drops on January 10th. And that is it for Air Talk today. I'm Queen Akim sitting in for Larry Mantle. Stay tuned for Film Week with guest host Rico Galliano. And that's coming up right after this on 89.3 KPCC.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Rico Galliano, sitting in for Larry Mantle today. Glad and honored to be here. First up this hour, we will be discussing the week's new movie releases, and later in the show, some of this year's most overlooked and underappreciated films. With me are a trio of our city's finest critics. We have Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the What the Flick podcast, Wade Major of Cinegods.com, and Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide, as well as Cinegods. You are all Cinegods to me. Welcome, everyone. So it is the very last film week of 2018, and we have a whopping 2 films to review. I think we can get through this. First up, Stan and Ollie. This is the biographical dramedy starring John C. Reilly and Steve Coogan as the comedy duo Laurel and Hardy. It is directed by John S. Baird. Jeff Pope is the screenwriter. They're squeaking this in at the end of December just in time to qualify for the Oscars. So, Christy, tell us, is it Little Gold Man worthy?
It is quite lovely. The performances are quite lovely. Yeah.
Right.
So Steve Coogan and John C. Reilly are Stan, Laurel, and Oliver Hardy. And the film begins when they're pretty much at their heyday in the late 1930s. And they're working with Hal Roach, and they're firing all cylinders, and they have various wives and girlfriends, and it's all working out for them. And then you flash forward to the mid-50s. And that brand of humor has long since gone out of fashion. Mm-hmm. And they no longer have the cachet that they did. And they're no longer in the kind of demand that they had been in. And so they find themselves in the position of having to do kind of this comeback tour through Britain. And they are not staying at the poshest hotels. And they are not booked at the most prestigious ornate theaters. They're in these tiny halls, and they're not selling out these tiny halls. And it's how they try to not necessarily recreate, but at least hold on to the last vestiges of that magic. And it's kind of amazing the detail with which these actors recreate, you know, specific dance routines or specific comedy routines, and they have to get that same perfect timing down. And what they're doing looks subtle and effortless, but clearly a great deal of work went into getting all of that right, because there's a ton of evidence to show us what it really looked like when these guys were performing.
Sure.
And John C. Reilly has to do a whole lot of work in prosthetics as Oliver Hardy is gaining in girth over the years. And so it's sort of a more physical and kind of a showier role. What Steve Coogan is doing is no less difficult, though. It's very, very subtle. And that chemistry is just tremendous. It's a lovely film. If you love movies, if you love comedy, you'll dig it. But there's also a great underlying undercurrent of melancholy, because you know that this thing that was so wonderful, that they loved and they were great at, that really identified them for so long, is going away.
It's a really interesting dynamic in that this is a UK production, and yes, it's about their tour of the UK. But at the same time, there's something interesting about the idea that certain American figures, and we could talk about, you know, jazz musicians appreciated in France, and you know, others from different eras where they are appreciated more overseas than they are in their own country at a certain point. And Laurel and Hardy were quite beloved around the world, and more so longer after their success in the United States. And this kind of gets into that, and how appreciated they were there relative to here. It has a lot to say about celebrity. I don't know if it says enough. It was written by Jeff Pope, who got an Oscar nomination for his Philomena screenplay, and obviously has some cred with Steve Coogan.
Yeah, right.
But
who starred in that film?
So you know, two Steve Coogan productions here. But it's it misses the mark just a tiny bit, and it's not enough to not make it a good film. It just feels like a British television production much of the time. It feels like it was dialed back just a little bit, and I understand why, because I was in a room of 17-year-olds after I'd seen the film, and I said, anybody here, you know, fan of Laurel and Hardy? And it was a room full of blank stares, and wow. I realized we've missed the boat with the current generation.
Sure.
Laurel and Hardy are not only not popular, they are unknown.
Yeah, when we grew up, it was on television.
All the time. So I understand why they had to dial it back in terms of budget, production value, and the whole thing. They had to take a little bit of the edge off because they simply don't have the same cultural awareness today that they used to.
Tim, you agree?
I absolutely do with both of those analysis. It's an interesting thing, though. You know, they had a bad breakup. These guys, it's kind of like, you know, a lot of the comedy teens, Dean and Lewis, you know, they had this really bad breakup, and didn't see each other for years and years and years, and so this was a real reuniting of them, right? Stan Laurel, he was the businessman and kind of the idea guy. Totally opposite of the character that he played, you know, sort of the goofball. No, he was the one
Dimley.
That sort of came up with these ideas and sort of blocked them all out. And Oliver Hardy would be like, oh, I see what you want to mean. And he would just sort of do it, you know. And then there are these wives.
who just steal the movie.
And not that the guys aren't doing great work, but they're contained within the thing that they have to do. These women are just absolutely Shirley Henderson and Nina Arianda. As their respective wives, they're just absolutely fantastic, funny, great supporting cast too.
And Nina Arianda plays Ida Laurel, who was Russian, so she's, you know, the Russian accent somehow gives all of her just snarky, deadpan comments about everything this added layer of just joy. She steals almost every scene she's in. But I think that it's a great point that it's more about the women than it is about them on a certain level. Yes, it's about them and their friendship and their celebrity, but the wives are the ones who are sort of driving this and who are making them who they are. And I think we've often overlooked the relevance of the wives.
Yeah, Nina Arianda, I was so concerned at first because it is a big, showy role.
Oh,
I thought, oh God, this is going to be like a one-note, broad, like, moose and squirrel hunting kind of Russian role. But she has so much room for shading and for pathos. Yeah, and they could do their own buddy comedy, the two of them together.
Yeah. Easily.
Excellent. Stan and Ollie is the film starring John C. Reilly and Steve Coogan, directed by John S. Baird. It's rated PG, and you can see it at the Arclight in Hollywood. Next up on this massive list of two films, A 12-Year Night, another biopic. This one's a drama. This is from Uruguay, written and directed by Alvaro Breckner, starring Antonio de la Torre, Chino Darín, and Alfonso Tort. Wade?
Such a well-meaning film. I hate prefacing things with that. It's well-meaning. It's well done in many respects. You know, Uruguay does not have its own substantial film industry to any great degrees. Many of these things are South American co-productions.
One's Argentine co-production.
Yeah. So in Argentina has a very robust film industry. But basically, it's a prison movie. It starts in 1973 when the military dictatorship took over, and there are three activists in particular who are thrown into prison and put into these horrible conditions, complete and total isolation for 12 years. And it is essentially their ordeal in prison. Significant because one of them eventually goes on to become president of Uruguay from 2010 to 2015. So, you know, he's kind of, I guess, the Uruguayan Mandela in some sense, and that is what the film effectively celebrates. But if you strip that away, it really is kind of a second-tier Papillon, Bridge on the River Kwai, Angelina Jolie did it in Unbroken. You know, it's just a prison film. It's just a, you know, a guy's in prison in a survival ordeal, and we've seen that so much, it just doesn't add anything.
All right. I like a good prison film, though. Tim, do you have a different point of view?
Not that much. I mean, who knew they'd treat you badly?
Yeah.
And that Uruguayan prison, man.
It gets bad and then it gets worse, is what you're saying.
Somehow I kind of expected that would happen. And as it happens, a friend of Wade and I, who happens to be from Argentina by way of Uruguay, she was born in Uruguay, and she was in town, and I watched this film with her, and you know, we watched the film. She's like, he wasn't that great of a president.
Pepe Mujica.
Yeah, he legalized marijuana, but you know. Yeah. Yeah. and that in and of itself was a little deflating. Yeah. But in the context of just a piece of drama, it's perfectly salvageable, watchable piece of drama, a little historical if you have some interest in this sort of thing. But is it deeply moving and touching, and will it, you know, enlighten you about? No, not really.
It All felt right, to me like if Julian Schnabel had made a prison film, that's what this feels like to me. Because
wow.
It's super gauzy and artful in its brutality. And
that's a good point.
I will acknowledge it gets its arms around a lot because it is 12 entire years in prison, but you also have these flashbacks to who these men were prior to being taken captive, and it's really efficient in just the imagery of telling you who each of these guys were. Like a moment in a field with a kid learning how to ride a bike tells you a lot about what kind of father one of these men was. There's a funny thing with the prisoner who is a writer who has a nice little friendship with a couple of the different guards who realize, okay, this guy's useful to me to help me woo my sweetheart or whatever it is. So it has its moments beyond just, you know, monotonous brutality.
Including a couple of really good supporting performances. The one that plays his mother, Pepe's mom, she was extraordinary.
Yes, right. She was.
It's a 12-Year Night, written and directed by Alvaro Brechner. This was also Uruguay's official entry for the Best Foreign Film Oscar. Did not make the shortlist. It's unrated and streaming on Netflix, and that's the week movies. Thank you, Christy, Wade, and Tim, for the grueling labor you put into watching all two of them. We will be back with Film Week right after this break. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Welcome back to the show. I'm Rico Galliano, and we are joined by critics Christy Lemire, Tim Cogshell, and Wade Major. We are near the end of 2018. I don't know how that happened. It was a year full of noteworthy cinema. But with everyone talking about the few films deservedly getting Oscar buzz, we figured we should take some time to look back at some fine movies we feel deserve some extra love, that perhaps got lost amidst the 12,000 or so films that got released this year. That's a real number, by the way. I got that off IMDb.
Mm-hmm.
Our critics have combed through that haystack to find some glittering needles. So for our most overlooked and underappreciated films of 2018, Wade, I want to start with you.
Oh, yeah.
Because
about
underappreciated.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
At the top of your list is one of the most generally maligned flicks of the year. Tell us what it is and defend yourself,
I'm going to defend Life Itself. And while I defend it, I am not going to make eye contact with Christy because I won't like the way that she's looking at me. I know it. I can feel it just on the side of my face right now. I can feel it. Look, Life Itself from writer-director Dan Fogelman, who, of course, is the creator and showrunner of This Is Us on television, which is a beloved show.
Of course.
Also wrote and directed Danny Collins a few years ago with Al Pacino, another underrated movie which I adored. I think Fogelman has a very unique talent, which is he's able to get inside relationships and kind of inside characters' heads as a writer in a way that very few other writers do. Mm. I realize Life Itself, which spins this elaborate kind of multi-generational, multi-continent tapestry of a family's relationships and hopes and dreams, and I realize a lot of people thought it was just, you know, over-elaborate and schmaltzy and really sentimental and contrived and so forth. But it is an incredibly well-crafted script. if you know anything about how screenplays have to be put together and what the writing process entails, it really is a beautiful, beautiful piece of work. And I think people might just simply be in the wrong frame of mind right now, given what's going on in the world and in the country and politics and economics and everything, that nobody really wants to sort of let this gem inside their heart. Give it 10 years. Give it 10 more years. Revisit this movie. You will be shocked how touching it is and how much you like it.
All right. Any comment from the Peanut again. Gallery?
I would think that a movie like this would be exactly what the world needs now, right now.
Love, if
it,
sweet love?
If it is indeed the movie that you are describing, but it is not. This movie is whack. This movie is trying so hard to be so profound and so poignant, and the ways in which all of the different characters' lives are intertwined is not nearly as, like, exciting and awe-inspiring. Like, you know from the very beginning who's going to be whose daughter and who's going to end up hooking up with who. Yes.
No. I don't think I knew that.
Yes.
But Christy's not wrong. although Wade's not wrong about something, there's an idea, in a through line in this movie that I do like. And Oscar Isaac's performance in particular it was extremely captivating to me. Him and Annette Bening, she's his therapist, and they have these sort of conversations. And that sort of drew me in quite deeply. He's involved in this relationship with this young woman. He's obsessing. And then we start to break the movie apart a bit, right? And that's when we go off onto these other sort of tributaries and how this all comes back around to the central thing. You know, that's quite a journey, and I didn't buy it for a second.
All right. Take your pick, folks, of which critic you want to believe. That is life itself, a controversial choice indeed. Tim, you're up. What's your first pick?
Roxanne is my pick, which is just this really neat little movie that's based on something called the Roxanne Wars of 1984. You got to be about 50 to know about any of this. So anyway, there was a young woman named Lolita Shante Gooden, born in 1969. She's about 14 years old in the early 80s, and she became known as one of the best MCs, street MCs, off-the-cuff MCs in Queensborough.
Yeah.
This girl could go. There's a little bit of footage of her on YouTube back during her younger days. Somebody shot with maybe a VHS camera or something, or whatever they had back then. But if you want to see somebody go, this girl could go. And she ate grown men alive on the street. This movie opens with a scene. She's 13 years old. Her mom's played by Nia Long. Guy wants to do a rap battle with her. She walks over there. All these people are gathered around. Nia Long, this is going to be a rap battle for $50. She says to her mama, "Is it okay if I cuss?" Nia Long says, "You say anything you want to as long as you get me that $50. And we cut. Her life was tough. She did, in fact, build herself a sort of a career as a little nascent rock superstar. But when she was 16 years old, she got involved with this man played by Mahershala Ali in this movie.
Yeah.
And her mother kicked her out. There's all kinds of complications. She got to she turned 16. There was a producer and a bad lawyer. A really interesting story. And this is what's interesting. The young actress who plays her in this movie is an actress named Shante Adams. A recent Carnegie Mellon graduate.
My hometown of Pittsburgh.
This is her first movie. That Shante in her name, she was named after Roxanne's Shante. Her mom actually named that. Went back that forth. There was a connection all the way back. You look at her; she looks just like Roxanne Shante.
Amazing.
They have the same face. She can MC. When you see her spitting in this movie, that's her spitting. It's just really, really amazing little movie about this little chunk of history in 1984 New York, a foundational figure in hip-hop. And who is it? A woman. A foundational figure in hip-hop is a woman. That a little girl at the time.
That I do appreciate about it, because so many films about rap music are always about men, and the women are just like on the side.
Indeed. All right, Roxanne, that's streaming now on Netflix for those who want to check it out. And let us move on to you, Christy. What underrated movie you want to give a shout-out to?
Thoroughbreds. I love this movie so much. If you loved Heathers, you will love Thoroughbreds. It's about these two teenage girls in a very posh suburban Connecticut neighborhood, and they're played by Anya Taylor-Joy and Olivia Cooke. Anya Taylor-Joy seems totally perfect on the outside. Gorgeous, giant house, and perfectly coiffed at all times, preppy chic everywhere. And Olivia Cooke is a friend from her childhood that she has to reconnect with at the end of her senior year.
Now, wait,
and,
is that the same Olivia Cooke who's in Life Itself? Yes, I think it is. Okay,
it might
carry
be.
On. Carry
but
on.
If you're going to see one Olivia Cooke film this year, make it Thoroughbred.
But you don't have to.
So it all comes back to life itself. It's profound, isn't it, Wade? It really is. So these two young ladies, they're like 17 years old. They're in this posh suburb. And they seem totally different. And you realize that Olivia Cooke might be a sociopath. She might feel nothing. And her ability to affect emotions is just chilling. And so the two of them come up with a plan to kill Anya Taylor-Joy's stepfather, who is horrible and verbally abusive and just cruel and arrogant. But they need help. And so they get help from the random townie drug dealer played by Anton Yelchin in what I believe is his last film, if not one of his last, and he brings some much needed humanity to it. This is the directorial debut of Corey Finley, who was a playwright for a while, and there is definitely a staginess to the way this film is blocked and shot and cut and just the pacing of it, but it's precise, it is chilling. Beautiful use of tracking shots in this giant mansion to make you feel more and more claustrophobic. And these two young actresses have amazing chemistry with each other. Go see Thoroughbreds.
It really was a good movie. I liked it too.
Thoroughbreds. And we're going to move on back to Wade with a film that ended up on both you and Tim's list here. It's called A Boy, A Girl, A Dream.
And Christy and I talked very positively about this on the radio when it was released. A Boy, A Girl, A Dream, directed by Kasim Basir, written and directed by Kasim Basir. It's his third film. And got absolutely no love, released in one theater in Baldwin Hills. And it's an extraordinary movie, entirely one shot, although I think Christy suspects otherwise.
I believe you.
Okay. All right.
Not everything has to be controversial.
Oh, but we're doing it for the audience. But it's essentially a story of a guy and a girl who meet one night, and it's the night, it's election night, 2016. But the election's entirely in the background, on the radio, on television. And when it comes into the foreground, it's not as a significant thing. It's like it's interfering with life. Mm-hmm. And there's a really interesting message in here, which is live your life and don't let the media culture intrude and control what you think and what you do. And it's the way that this relationship evolves over several different places over one night. What's really unfortunate here is what I've just described to you is a movie that anybody should be interested in. If I tell you, oh, it's an all-black cast. Well, Sam Goldwyn obviously made a calculation at that point. Uh-oh, you know what that's like. Unless we have a major name, and obviously they didn't, you know,
Mario Hardwick and Megan Good.
They're not big enough names to make this a mainstream film that we
great
could put
performances,
in.
Though.
So they dropped it in Baldwin Hills, and it disappeared. And it's a tragedy because it's a really wonderful film. And Christy says something super smart, too, because she knows me so well. You did. I'm gonna throw you a bone because she said, Wade, you know why you like this? Because it's a low-budget La La Land. And she's right.
Yeah.
She's right.
Yeah. It is fascinating. It all takes place, if you know Hollywood, it takes place in about one square mile of West Hollywood-ish.
Yeah.
But it still feels epic, even though it only takes place in a few places. It's
beautiful movie, and it's so well-crafted. And the performances are so good, and it comes to this exclamation point at the end that is just poetic, and I love this movie.
There's a moment in that movie. It's just one of the best filmmaking moments that I've seen in years in a movie. When he finally shows her the film that he made, not a word of dialogue in this moment. The camera just floats back and forth. You know everything about them and about what just happened in that scene.
That is called A Boy, A Girl, A Dream. It is a remarkable film. And I'm going to invoke host privilege here and throw in one of my own favorite underrated movies of the year, if nobody minds.
Go ahead.
Right? I was going to do it anyway, even if you did. This is El Angel. It's a crime drama, and it was Argentina's entry for the Best Foreign Film Oscar. Did not get on the shortlist, which does not surprise me a bit. It's based on the true story of Carlos Puch, also known as the Angel of Death, who started out as a petty thief in early 1970s Argentina, but by age 15 was also committing murders. This is apparently a segment we're going to be talking a lot about sociopaths. Watching this performance by a new actor named Lorenzo Ferro is like gazing into the abyss. Amazing. We're going to be back in just a minute with more of our favorite underrated films of the year. This is Film Week. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Welcome back. I'm Rico Galliano, joined by critics Tim Cogshell, Wade Major, and Christy Lemire. We are pitching our picks for the most overlooked films of the year. There are so many of them, but let's see what else we can cram in here. Wade, what is next on your list?
Borg versus McEnroe.
Excellent choice.
Which neon completely bonked earlier in the year, and I don't know why. Even if you're not a tennis fan, this is an this is an amazing movie. Shia LaBeouf and Sverrir Gudnason play McEnroe and Borg, and it centers around this legendary U.S. Open final in the 80s, which I watched at the time.
I watched it too.
And even though I remembered how it ended, and I remembered every beat and every twist and turn of that incredibly dramatic thing, it didn't matter because it's not really about that. The recreation of it technically is amazing, but it's about celebrity. It's about how two very different people deal with fame, deal with anger, deal with ambition, and just cope with what is arguably the changing of the guard, in the greatest changing of the guard in the history of tennis. And it really is a remarkable film. It's so well crafted. I don't know why this film didn't do better. I don't know why it wasn't pushed better.
All of the crafts, particularly those two performances, which are just astounding. I'm a ridiculous tennis fan from way back in the day. Could have gone pro. But nevertheless, these are just amazing. And I literally did, like Wade, watch this, and they duplicate it with just such specificity. It's just amazing what they're doing here. And then these performances. I say on this show quite a lot, I'm a big Shia LaBeouf fan. I know we poke at him a lot, but that young man can act, and that's just all there is to it.
Right. It'd be very easy for him to just do, like, over-the-top McEnroe shtick, and it's much more than that. And you see the childhood reasons that he is that demanding of himself.
Yeah, and for Borg, too, what he went through as a tempestuous child to sort of pull it all back in. And what Borg keeps inside is what makes him, and what McEnroe lets loose is what makes him. And they're mirror images of each other. It's extraordinary.
I love a movie that doesn't have a bad guy. And in this movie, really, the bad guys are inside both
of them.
That's
it. That's it.
It's a really remarkable film. That's Borg versus McEnroe. Go check it out. Christy, what's next on your list?
Support the Girls, which maybe isn't totally overlooked at this point because Regina Hall has duly gotten some awards love for her performance.
So.
Yes, absolutely. It's about this highway sports bar, kind of like a Hooters-ish establishment in middle of nowhere, Texas. And Regina Hall is the manager of all these young women wearing itty-bitty t-shirts and little bitty jean shorts. And it takes place mostly over the course of a day at this just totally seemingly mundane American place, the sports bar with curves called Double Whammy. It's totally subtle.
That name.
Yes. Andrew Bujalski wrote and directed this. And he finds such humanity just in the prosaic beats of their daily life. And Regina Hall has never had a role like this that's allowed her to show so much of her talent. She's been around forever. She's always reliable in everything. What's fascinating here with this role is you get to watch her calibrate who she needs to be with each person as the day goes on to try to put out various fires, whether it's the cable has gone out or some obnoxious customer is there or she's dealing with her soon-to-be ex-husband or whatever it is. And you watch her just be steady as the crisis is mounting all around her. It looks like a Shaggy hang of a movie, and it is a primal scream.
And it literally ends with a primal scream. No spoilers.
There you go.
Now, I love this movie, too, and it is Regina who's the thing. And let me say this about that performance of hers. She's playing the sort of quintessential thing that any black man who grew up in a household with black women understands completely. The need to be the mother to just everybody. She's everybody in that movie's mom. She's even the goofy owner's mom, and he don't even know it. And how she has to shape them and maneuver them and push them. It's just this amazing, amazing performance. And I'm watching this movie, and I'm looking at her, and I'm like, that's my mom. That is my mom. And that's the way she's been doing things for 50 years. Really a great movie.
There are some good things in it. I'm not a fan of Bujalski. He's the father of mumblecore, going all the way back to Funny Ha Ha. And that's a style of filmmaking that grates on me. But I credit the actors for growing beyond his limitations.
Yeah, Shayna McHale also, by the way, a great performance
from her.
So great. Support the Girls, that's from writer-director Andrew Bujalski. By the way, here's some trivia. His next project, he wrote the screenplay of a live-action remake of Lady and the Tramp that is due out next year on Disney streaming service Disney Plus for reals.
Are the dogs going to talk?
I believe they do, actually.
Okay.
We'll see what happens
with
that.
That's a paycheck right there.
Tim, what's next on your list?
Lean on Pete. Definitely overlooked, slight little movie starring Charlie Plummer, Steve Buscemi, Chloe Sevigny. It's about this young man played by Plummer, who's this very slight boy, this actor. He's this very, very thin little fellow anyway, and it's important in the context of this movie. Because the thing that you feel as you're watching this movie about a boy and his horse, basically, a horse that he steals from Steve Buscemi, because this racehorse hasn't been winning. And Steve has made it clear what he does with horses that don't win. They end up in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And he falls for this horse, and he just can't let that happen. So he just steals him. And his father's this no-account guy who just can't, you know, he's not really a bad guy, but he can't take care of anything. And suddenly he finds himself on the road with this horse trying to get to his aunt's house out in Wyoming someplace, 2,000 miles from where he is. And it's just him and this horse, and he's talking to this horse, and this movie takes its time. And you have to sit there, and you suddenly realize this is just a deep existential dive. And you find yourself so afraid for this boy. A knot was in my stomach for this entire movie as this boy and this horse walk across the country trying to get to his auntie's. It's patient, it's profoundly civil, and it's a really good performance by Charlie Plummer, Steve Buscemi, and Chloe, and that horse.
I have to say, every time I've encountered this one, I've been on a plane and I've had the chance to play it, I've thought one of two things is going to happen here. Either this is going to be incredibly corny, or I'm going to be weeping in front of a lot of strangers.
Yeah.
You say it's more of the latter.
You're going to weep. It got me very, very deeply, and I deeply appreciate it.
Anyone else see this one?
Yes, I liked it. I don't think I liked it as much as Tim, but certainly has its bright spots.
All right. We got enough time for one more from you, I think, Wade, The Female Brain.
Super fast. I just want to send a shout out for The Female Brain, directed by Whitney Cummings, her directing debut. You know, I have never been a huge fan of Whitney Cummings before as a comedian. I didn't like her sitcom, but she finds her groove here. She's able to sort of assert herself. This is based on the nonfiction book by Luann Brizendine, I guess is how you pronounce the name. And she turned it into this incredibly poignant comedy drama study of the battle of the sexes and how men and women misunderstand each other and what makes a relationship work with these different couples. And it's just poignant and touching and incredibly accomplished. And I really hope Whitney Cummings keeps making movies as a filmmaker.
All right. Yes,
Blake Chrissy? Griffin's good in it.
Really good.
That's it.
No, everyone's good in it.
Chris, do you
want to? I was going to say it's a little bit like life itself, but see. You know.
But it has Blake Griffin, which makes it vaguely better.
Yeah. Chris, do you want to close us out with Disobedience?
Yes. I love this movie so much, and it came out way earlier in the year, so I suspect a lot of folks forgot about it. But it's Rachel Weisz and Rachel McAdams, and they knew each other in this Orthodox Jewish neighborhood of London. Rachel McAdams is now married to Alessandro Nivola, who was also a childhood friend of theirs. But that thing that connection between these two women was always there and is still there. Rachel Weisz has to come back when her father, who's the rabbi, dies. And it is passionate. It is bracingly honest. The women have gorgeous chemistry with each other. Alessandro Nivola is very good in it. And what could have been a thankless role as just the guy on the side, you really feel for him as well. This is a sexy and lovely film.
Rachel Weisz doing amazing work also in The Favorite.
Love The Favorite. Yeah. Best movie of the year.
And folks, yes. Sadly, I believe this is all the time we have. So much fun. Thank you, Christy, Tim, and Wade. And thank you, Film Week listeners, for sticking with me throughout this show. I am Rico Galliano. It has been a pleasure filling in for Larry Mantle. He will return for the next Film Week. Have a great weekend, and here's to more great movie going in 2019. Go out there and enjoy that lack of LA traffic right now.